I next met with Dr. Sandra Swain, and to begin, she discussed the background to the classic Cleopatra trial investigating the combination of chemotherapy, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab, a study that she co-chaired.
Originally, I did some work when I was at the NCI with pertuzumab and did a small trial with about a 20% response rate in patients who had already had trastuzumab, and then we added pertuzumab. And then also, Jose Bazalga did a large phase 2 study in Spain showing about a 25% or so response rate with pertuzumab, trastuzumab, and Luca Gianni had done one in patients who had HER2-negative disease that didn't have any responses. So that was kind of all the background that we really had for pertuzumab besides the preclinical data. And there was reluctance really to go much farther, but we finally convinced the company to do a large phase 3 trial, and that was the Cleopatra trial, where we were using it first line with chemotherapy because, as everyone knows, Danny Slaman's data did show a lot of synergy with trastuzumab and the taxanes. So we chose docetaxel because it was a worldwide study, and there was a lot of argument about that, frankly, and those of us in the U.S. were not very excited. Jose and I basically wrote the protocol and ran the trial, and we had a lot of difficulty with accrual, I think, in the U.S. because of the docetaxel backbone, because most of us don't use that in metastatic disease. But finally, after years, we were able to get the accrual to over 800 with only 16% of the patients in the U.S., I think, again, because of that docetaxel issue. Plus, everyone at the time was extremely excited about T-DM1. And pertuzumab was kind of, oh, it's just another trastuzumab. It's really not going to be that effective. And I have to say, when I first saw the results, it's been about 3 years ago now, I was shocked at how good they were, that we had a 6 months progression-free survival benefit. I really couldn't believe it. I didn't expect it to be that good.
I got to say, I was shocked too. I remember when I asked Jose Bazalga, he said, oh no, I expected it.
I admit I did not expect it to be that good because I knew that it was effective, but not that effective. And now having the survival benefit that, you know, I just published in the last year or so showing 56 months median survival is just incredible. And what I hear and what I see from my treatment and my colleagues who treat these patients and people who email me is that the response rates are fantastic and they're holding up in practice, not just in the clinical trial. And people are just seeing really, really good efficacy with it.
And in terms of practical implications of the study, I was talking about the patient who relapsed quickly, and that actually is one of the common questions that we get from oncologists. I'm not sure how often it happens, but those cases are particularly problematic. The patient who has an early relapse after receiving a taxane and trastuzumab. Actually, at one point, there was, an ASCO position paper, a consensus saying patients like that maybe ought to get T-DM1. How do you approach it in your own practice outside a trial setting?
Well, I would try to give them pertuzumab and trastuzumab, probably not with a taxane, maybe with fenofibrate, which is, we know that's a very active regimen with trastuzumab. I think it's reasonable to try T-DM1 in that setting, but T-DM1 also is basically trastuzumab with chemotherapy. So you still may not have a response in those patients. It's interesting that I had a patient like you're describing here. It wasn't a quick relapse, but she was on pertuzumab, trastuzumab, and docetaxel for metastatic disease for quite a while, probably over a year, and then recurred with some local disease. And I put her on T-DM1, and she just blew right through it. She didn't respond at all. And you may have seen the data from, again, Danny Slaman, Finn, and Slaman's group, showing palbociclib in cell lines being very active for HER2-positive cell lines. So I referred her, at the time we didn't have palbociclib available, to a clinical trial, and she was placed on palbociclib and 5-FU and had a dramatic response, a partial response, where she had blown right through T-DM1. So I think, you know, if these patients who are really resistant to the trastuzumab, the T-DM1, we may need to try something else.
So is that a strategy that you would maybe implement in your own practice outside a trial setting? I guess an ER-positive disease, it maybe it wouldn't be that complicated because you already have an indication. What about an ER-negative, HER2-positive disease?
Well, I think it would be hard to probably get approval for that. We are actually going to do a clinical trial with trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and we're trying to do it also with palbociclib. So I would try to put them on a trial rather than just do it as a standard treatment, because I think it would be hard to get approval for that.
So another thing relevant to this issue of the early relapse or the patient who's relapsed after having a taxane and trastuzumab, you mentioned, you know, your interest in trying to use pertuzumab. And I've heard people say, well, they want to use pertuzumab first line so they're sure they can get it. So even if they want to maybe try TDM first, they're kind of reluctant because they're concerned they might not be able to get pertuzumab. First of all, do you think that is a practical problem? Have you been able to access pertuzumab in later line therapy? And biologically, is there any reason to think it would be less effective?
Well, I don't think biologically there would be a reason. It's variable in getting it approved. We've had pretty good luck with that. And if you look at the ASCO guidelines, they do say that in there. If the patient has not had pertuzumab, that they would recommend getting pertuzumab. I don't know if that helps with some of the reimbursement, but I haven't heard a lot of difficulty with that.
So we have this really exciting data from the CLEOPATRA trial, and then along comes Marianne. Again, can you talk about what was going on at the time Marianne was planned and the design of the study?
The Marianne trial was designed before CLEOPATRA data was out at all. So the standard arm was the taxane with trastuzumab. Hindsight, we would have loved now for that to be the CLEOPATRA arm with pertuzumab, but it wasn't. So it was the standard at that time, comparing the T-DM1 pertuzumab and then to T-DM1 alone. So in hindsight, we should have added the pertuzumab there, but it's always hard to know these answers as you're designing them without results. The results, as you know, were very disappointing with really no benefit. There were similar results. It was non-inferior, the T-DM1 pertuzumab, but it certainly wasn't superior like we had hoped it would be.
And just to clarify, there was one arm that had pertuzumab and T-DM1. There was one arm that was T-DM1 alone. Those two arms looked the same. And then the third arm with trastuzumab and a taxane also looked the same. So all three looked the same. And as you mentioned, I guess the first thing was there was an expectation that just as in the CLEOPATRA trial, you were going to see a benefit to adding pertuzumab. Any theoretical explanations or practical explanations that you have or you've heard that appeal to you about what happened there?
Well, for one, you have less trastuzumab present, since it's probably about one-third the amount of trastuzumab. And you have, you know, a small amount of chemotherapy there with that. So that's one possible explanation with that arm. I don't have any other good explanations, really. I think that somehow the trastuzumab, pertuzumab together and the doses that they're given just are more active.
I guess the other issue is through indirect comparison, since T-DM1 in the Marianne trial seems similar to trastuzumab chemotherapy, I guess the conclusion is being made indirectly that CLEOPATRA would be better than both. Is that your conclusion?
Yes. Indirectly, you would say that because you don't have the best arm from CLEOPATRA in there, right?
So first of all, how do the Marianne results change, if at all, your algorithm? What is your clinical algorithm, metastatic disease?
They really don't change it. I just saw a couple of patients recently, one who presented with stage 4 disease, and I used paclitaxel and pertuzumab, trastuzumab for her. And I saw another patient and recommended docetaxel. She was younger and she was very active, and I wanted to get it over quicker because you can, you know, just give the 6 cycles of chemo, which is what I usually do if they have a response, and then stop the chemotherapy and give the trastuzumab, pertuzumab. So, I mean, that's a question too, is do you use docetaxel or paclitaxel? And in my discussing with a lot of people, most people seem to start with the docetaxel because of, I guess, the publication. But the paclitaxel can be easier on patients. And as you know, Chow Dang published the study using paclitaxel with trastuzumab, pertuzumab, showing very good efficacy and less diarrhea. Now, diarrhea is a significant toxicity with the triple combination.
I'm just kind of curious, this patient who presented with stage 4 disease, what did the primary tumor look like?
What did it look like?
I mean, was it a large, you know, tumor or small?
It wasn't that large. I think it was 3 or 4 centimeters. I guess you could say that's large. And she presented with hip pain and had bone disease. And it's really interesting. And I was kind of surprised at this, but her local oncologist, you know, they did a biopsy. It was HER2 positive, ER positive. They recommended hormonal therapy alone, which I was very surprised about.
Wow.
Yeah, I wouldn't have expected that. And I told her that I would, you know, use the chemotherapy with the pertuzumab, trastuzumab, and she had an excellent response, has had just about a complete response. Did get the paclitaxel for a while, but didn't tolerate it very well. You know, paclitaxel was not tolerated very well because she started having some neuropathy.
Yeah, the reason I was asking about the size of the primary is I was just wondering whether you ever, you know, because you hopefully will see, and in fact you did see a really good response, do you ever remove the primary or do local surgery, and particularly in these people with great responses?
No, I haven't done that. I really haven't. You know, there's ongoing studies in the U.S. looking at that question, if survival is improved by locally treating the primary, but I don't usually do that.
So another question I have for you is, do you see any role for pertuzumab and trastuzumab without chemotherapy? We saw in the Neosphere neoadjuvant study, there's a subset of patients who had PathCR with that. Is that a strategy ever used, for example, in an older, frail patient?
I think it definitely could be used. I mean, the use of trastuzumab and pertuzumab alone in the Neosphere study, especially in patients who had the ER negative, HER2 positive disease, was almost a 30% PathCR rate. And that's really high. So if you do have an older person who you really don't want to give any chemotherapy to, especially if the tumor's ER negative, I think it's very reasonable to try that.
What about trials in the adjuvant and neoadjuvant setting? There's the AFFINITY trial out there. What's the design for that study, and when are we going to see an answer to it?
So the AFFINITY trial completed accrual a while ago, and it compared AC followed by trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and taxane versus AC followed by trastuzumab, placebo, and taxane. And it really was one of the reasons, because it had completed accrual, that pertuzumab got approved in the neoadjuvant setting, because number one, Cleopatra was very positive, the Neosphere and Triphena data showed high PathCR rates, and then AFFINITY had accrued. So the FDA felt comfortable approving it in the neoadjuvant setting as an accelerated approval. Now we have to see if the efficacy will be there. The results aren't out yet. I don't know when they'll be out, maybe sometime in the next year or two.
So that also leads into the very controversial question of pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting outside a trial. And you were nice enough to participate along with about 60 other investigators in a survey we just did, asking a whole bunch of questions, but one of them was, are there situations where you use pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting, either with chemo or all the way out to a year? I was really surprised. It was about half of them, including you, actually, who said that they use it. What do you do yourself? And what is your thinking? I kind of have found it a little surprising, the whole thing with the NCCN and everything. I don't remember a time in oncology where this has really happened like this.
Well, I don't remember a time in breast cancer where we've had such stunning results and survival benefit, you know, with a 56-month median survival in metastatic disease, and we're all seeing such great responses. So I really think it's the answer to your question is related to that, as the efficacy is so good that we hate to think when we have a patient we know has positive nodes or has a fairly high recurrence rate that we're not giving the best we possibly can. I really think that's the reason for it. I mean, it's hard for me being data-driven to do it in some ways because we don't have those results yet. We could potentially be giving patients more, and we do give them more toxicity. But I think it's, you know, if I were that person, I would want to have the pertuzumab in that setting.
Now, when you do that, is it just with the chemo or out to a year?
Usually just with the chemo.
And you've been able to get it paid for?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I ever told you, but we did a national survey of both oncologists and researchers. We had like 50 investigators in February 2005. And we presented node-positive, HER2-positive cases and said, would you give trastuzumab off-study? And I mean, like, nobody was doing it. Nobody. And of course, that May, the data came out. We repeated the survey that summer and everybody was doing it. So somehow I wonder if what's going on right now is people having lived through that experience and seen people relapse that maybe might not have relapsed.
Right. No, I think that's right. And we do have T-DM1 if patients do relapse, or we have pertuzumab, but we don't cure them. So I think, you know, for me, I don't want to see people relapsing, and none of us do.
So you mentioned the issue of toxicity with pertuzumab, and it's always a little challenging to dissect that out when a drug's being used with other agents, particularly with chemotherapy. At this point, both in terms of data that's come out of trials as well as your own personal experience, what's your take in terms of what pertuzumab does add to toxicity?
Pertuzumab clearly adds diarrhea toxicity. I mean, the diarrhea is about 60% in the arm with pertuzumab, and it's some grade 3 or 4, and I think it's about 9 or 10%. So that's really pretty darn significant. And it is concerning. So we are actually going to do a trial. I'm doing an investigator-initiated trial during prophylaxis for diarrhea, because I'm very concerned about that. And I do get a lot of emails about it. And people do have patients who have severe diarrhea and dehydration, and it's a terrible toxicity for patients.
Anything else? What about dermatologic?
Yes, there is dermatologic toxicity in probably 25% or so of patients. I haven't personally seen a lot of that. I've had patients who've had rashes that have kind of come and gone. You do get rashes even with docetaxel quite frequently, but it is increased for sure in patients who get pertuzumab. The other thing to note is that febrile neutropenia is greater, especially in the Asian population. It's about 25% in that group, probably because of the diarrhea and the mucositis being increased. So you have the breakdown of the mucosal barriers, and then you get the febrile neutropenia, because we know with 75 per meter squared of docetaxel, most patients do have neutropenia.
You know, that case that you mentioned of the patient who got started on endocrine therapy and then came to see you is kind of ringing in my head a little bit right now. Are there any situations with first-line metastatic disease, HER2-positive, that you could imagine where you would not want to give some kind of anti-HER therapy?
No, actually none, because I would, if anything, give them endocrine therapy with anti-HER2 therapy and not give chemotherapy. Most of the time now we do, and in the ASCO guidelines that just came out last summer do recommend for patients who have ER-positive, HER2-positive metastatic first-line disease to get chemo plus HER2-targeted therapy. But there are cases where I could imagine that I would do endocrine therapy and HER2-targeted therapy, but not without HER2-targeted therapy.
Right. And I know there's a trial looking at this, but do you ever do endocrine therapy, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab without chemo?
I haven't done it, but I would consider doing it.
And also, as long as we also brought up the issue of T-DM1, what's your experience with that drug in terms of tolerability? What have you observed? And what do we know about T-DM1 and, for that matter, a Cleopatra-type regimen in terms of efficacy in the brain?
Well, T-DM1 is so well tolerated in most patients, with the toxicity just being elevated liver functions or decreasing in platelets. And the patients I've seen have done exceedingly well on it. I had a patient who was on, one that just sticks in my mind a lot, who was on the Amelia trial and was randomized to lapatinib capecitabine. We had a terrible time, and she was a trooper, getting her through even 4 cycles of that because of all the pills and the nausea and the diarrhea. And then she progressed and was put on T-DM1 on compassionate use and had an unbelievable response for about a year, and it just turned around the disease. So in many patients, it's just great because the quality of life is so good with very low toxicity.
What have you observed, and what do we know from the clinical trials in terms of thrombocytopenia and liver dysfunction?
Well, they do have decreased platelets and elevated liver function tests, but you can, in the patient that I described, who had the great response on T-DM1, actually had to, after the first cycle, because both of those things happened, had a dose reduction, and she still continued to respond. So I think that it's like anything, our doses aren't really absolutely 100% clear that we need as much as we do. And I think you asked me another question, now I can't remember what it was.
Brain mets.
Oh, brain mets, right. When we looked at the brain mets in the Cleopatra study, the patients, there were about the same number of patients who had brain mets, but they had a delayed recurrence in the brain. So the thinking there is that the systemic therapy was so good and was effective systemically that it did delay the seeding of the brain and showing up of the CNS mets. And there's been a study, the cerebral study, in which patients were randomized to get, I think it's lapatinib or trastuzumab, I think that's what it was, but the time to CNS mets was measured, was the primary endpoint of the study, and it really basically showed there was no difference between lapatinib or trastuzumab. However, the progression-free survival was much better in those patients who got trastuzumab, which I think is very interesting because you hear a lot of times, or we used to hear, people saying that we should use lapatinib for people with HER2-positive brain mets, and I'm not sure that's really the case. I don't think either one probably effectively treats the brain mets.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if there's anything. I mean, you know, for example, in lung cancer, we see in people with EGFR mutations, ALK rearrangements, these people actually have responses in the brain. Anything do that with breast cancer?
Not really, not that I know of. I just haven't seen it. I mean, you know, Nancy Lin's done a lot of work at Dana-Farber with lapatinib and other things, and it's not been very dramatic. I mean, there's been some responses, but in looking at the data like the cerebral study and all the other studies, it just doesn't look like it's, you know, a winner.
Another question, we were talking about thrombocytopenia. Have clinically significant bleeds been reported with T-DM1, or have you observed any?
Well, I think there have been some reported because I, you know, get all the adverse event reporting. So there's been an occasional report, but I haven't seen it. And I think it's really uncommon.
Another thing, we were talking about T-DM1 in the metastatic setting. There now is a study, I guess, comparing it to the paclitaxel trastuzumab regimen developed at Dana-Farber in the adjuvant setting. What are your thoughts about that study, and what do you see as the future, if any, of T-DM1 in the adjuvant setting?
I really like that study. Just to give a little background, we know that trastuzumab is very effective in the adjuvant setting, but a lot of patients probably don't need the extensive chemotherapy that we give them. So the Dana-Farber group did a trial where it was non-randomized, where they gave patients paclitaxel and trastuzumab in patients who had node negative disease that was less than 3 centimeters and had really outstanding results. It's only 3-year results published in New England Journal of Medicine, but even I think the patients with ER positive disease had a 99% disease-free survival, and it was 98% or so for those that were ER negative. So outstanding results. So I wanted to make that point because I think that's an option for some patients now just to have the paclitaxel and trastuzumab. And then to follow up on that study was looking at the T-DM1 versus the paclitaxel and trastuzumab. And I think it's a great study. I think that some patients who have this more limited primary disease don't need the big guns chemotherapy that we give. So I like it. At ASCO, Nadia Harbeck presented a trial where they looked at neoadjuvant T-DM1 and had really, really high past CR rates, which was a very interesting study. So I think that data supports putting it in a situation where you have lower risk of recurrence in the adjuvant setting.
You know, you talk about using, quote, big guns, and I mean, is it possible that you'd get the same results with paclitaxel as you get using the big guns, for example, taxane and anthracycline or TCH?
I think definitely it's possible. I think that will be one of the questions of the future. Can we back off on some of these things which give so much toxicity to patients?
Another data set in HER2-positive disease I want to ask you about that was presented at ASCO was the so-called Extenet study, looking at the TKI neratinib after adjuvant chemotherapy, kind of an interesting design. Could you go back over how they actually did that study and what it showed and what you think it means?
Well, the patients had all had trastuzumab, and then they were randomized to get neratinib versus placebo after that for, I think it was for a year now, if I remember right. The trial closed when the drug company sold the drug, I guess. I don't know all the exact details, but it closed with a short follow-up. But then it was reopened for collecting data later on by a different company. And what was presented at ASCO was basically a 2.3% disease-free survival benefit in those patients who got the neratinib. However, I don't think that there was a total data collection for all patients because the company has not submitted it yet to the FDA, so I don't know what's really going on with all of that. There's also a lot of toxicity with it, that there's diarrhea in almost 100% of patients who do get the neratinib, but it's a very active drug. It's an irreversible tyrosine kinase inhibitor. One interesting aspect of the drug is, I know Matt Ellis was looking at it in patients who had HER2 mutations, showing a lot of activity in that situation. So I think it is a good drug. It just may not have the right home yet in breast cancer patients.
I was curious about the design, the post-adjuvant, which of course, I guess you have to start out with people who have residual risk of relapse. It's pretty significant after adjuvant therapy. What do you think about that approach? Are these patients high enough risk that you can actually see some results? And do you think that kind of design would make sense with, you know, another treatment, maybe better tolerated, for example, T-DM1?
Well, I'd like to see it actually up front rather than wait for giving standard treatment. So one of the trials that's ongoing right now is the Catherine study, in which T-DM1 is randomized, or patients have neoadjuvant treatment, and then if they have any residual disease, they're randomized to get T-DM1 or not. So I think that's a reasonable design.
So another data set I wanted to ask you about came out at ASCO. I was surprised after so many years to see it. Richard Margulies presented a study looking at, now it seems like kind of an antiquated question, of anastrozole versus tamoxifen, but in DCIS. Do you want to comment on what was seen there and what you think it means?
Well, I think the B35 study showed that anastrozole was basically a little bit better than tamoxifen for DCIS. So, you know, it wasn't earth-shattering result, but it certainly shows us that we can use either anastrozole or tamoxifen in patients who have DCIS.
What's your own approach right now to the use of endocrine therapy in DCIS? And also, there is an oncotype assay for DCIS, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about that.
Well, the oncotype assay, even in the low-risk patients, has a recurrence rate of about 10%, so I don't really use it. I think the only time I've recommended it, it's been a couple times in patients who I felt should get radiation but didn't want radiation. So I suggested it to them that we could test that, and if it was high enough, to try to convince them to get radiation. Neither one of them actually would agree to it because they said they weren't going to take radiation regardless. But I haven't, so I don't really use that test. I do recommend hormonal therapy for all the patients who have ER-positive DCIS.
And when you use adjuvant hormonal therapy, both in DCIS as well as in invasive disease, how do you deal with the issue of duration of treatment?
Well, for DCIS, because the trials only use it for 5 years, I just do 5 years or recommend 5 years of hormonal therapy. For patients in whom I'm using adjuvant endocrine therapy, if I start with the AI, I'm usually just giving 5 years unless they're very high risk. For example, have a lot of positive nodes, or that would be the main example. I would usually give them longer therapy, 10 years of an AI. And then in premenopausal women, still have lots of discussion about that one. If they're fairly low risk, tamoxifen still looks pretty good if you look at the soft and text data. Discuss ovarian suppression with an AI in patients who have a higher risk. In some cases, we do that.
There are genomic assays that have looked at the issue of going beyond 5 years, of Prosigna, the breast cancer index, and Oncotype has been looked at that. Do you use any of those assays, and do you consider the Oncotype when a patient gets to 5 years?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the breast cancer index because I just got a result back today. So I started using it recently because of this question is, should we continue beyond 5 years? Because we know some patients just seem to have really low risk. They may have a low Oncotype result and they have a small tumor, it's node negative, and you're like, do they really need to be on hormonal therapy for 10 years? So I've started ordering it and probably ordered it in, you know, 3 or 4 patients recently. The one I just got back today was a 15% recurrence from 5 to 10 years, which is high. So in this case, I think it's helpful for this patient to discuss with her that I think we should continue the hormonal therapy.
I'm just curious, what was this patient's original tumor? What kind of endocrine therapy did she get?
She actually, if I remember because it's been a while, she had a BRCA mutation. So she had an oophorectomy and then was on an AI.
Interesting. How did she tolerate that?
She did fine.
And do you know her nodal status when she started out?
I can't. You know, it's been now 6 years. I can't remember.
Right. So this lady then, did she feel kind of reassured about continuing endocrine therapy? Or
I just got the result today, honestly.
That's
so I haven't talked to her yet about it, but I think she will.
What do you think about the documentation, the research database? It seems like that's something that people really look at in terms of genomic assays that underlies the breast cancer index. Do you feel confidence when you see that 15% rate that that's what it is?
Well, I think, you know, there's the one Lancet Oncology paper where they did look at it prospectively, and I think the data is pretty good. You know, I think it's better than my guess.
Interesting. What about in the initial diagnosis? Where do you stand today in using genomic predictors? Do you use the 21 gene recurrence score, MammaPrint, or any other assay in making these decisions?
Right now, I just use the Oncotype, and basically patients who have node negative disease and some patients with node positive disease too. I don't do it in every patient that has node positive disease. And it was interesting. I had another case that I saw a couple of weeks ago where she had an Oncotype of 25, which, as you know, is considered intermediate. But if you looked at the Taylor RX study, the 25 was the cutoff where a lot of people feel like patients should get chemo. And it was a node negative tumor, fairly small. I think it was less than a centimeter. So the discussion was, should we recommend chemo? And that's a hard discussion because we don't have data to show one way or another that the patient will benefit. But probably that kind of patient who has an ER positive tumor, and her tumor was ER positive, PR negative, has the luminal B type tumor that may respond or have more of an effect with chemotherapy. So I recommended chemotherapy for this patient. I don't know what she'll end up doing, but as I told her, she could get lots of different opinions on it.
Do you tend to alter the type of chemotherapy you recommend based on, for example, the recurrence score? Would you use more aggressive chemo if a patient has a high recurrence score?
Well, if the patients have no negative disease, I use TC, docetaxel, Cytoxan, for the most part, even with a higher recurrence score, I've done that.
The question always comes up of the patients who are running out of standard options. This happens in every tumor, obviously. Sometimes patients may be in very good condition. They may want to be as aggressive as possible. Any thoughts about next generation sequencing? We see docs sending this off in practice. Have you done that, and has it been helpful in any patients?
This is a really interesting and important question because we're, I think, at the tip of the iceberg here with that. I think eventually we're going to be doing the sequencing in all patients. Right now, we're doing as you suggested. Sometimes you send it, sometimes you don't. And actually in our own group, we're coming up with a consensus of which patients we're going to send it for with breast cancer. And we're just talking about that now. I personally have sent it several times. One example would be in patients who have metaplastic disease, where I know those patients don't respond to anything, any chemotherapy for sure. So I've sent it in those patients. I've sent it actually in the adjuvant setting for someone who had a lot of positive nodes And it was interesting. There was an indication that an mTOR inhibitor might be beneficial, so it pointed to the adjuvant trial there.
So the adjuvant everolimus trial?
Right, the adjuvant everolimus trial. I said I don't use it normally, but in this situation, it's in a trial, so I did. She did go on that trial.
That's interesting.
So I think that I'd like to see us doing it in all patients. It's expensive, but I think we're bound to be learning something in the future about these different mutations. And some, even though they may not be what they call actionable now, I think any information and data is going to be helpful to us in the future. So I have done it quite a few times. In fact, just saw someone yesterday who I recommended it for again, who just had her first recurrence. And it was an ER-positive tumor, but I think it can be helpful. And it does, for me, points to the clinical trials.
So that's interesting. You have a patient. What was the situation with the patient you saw yesterday? It's interesting that first recurrence and you got next-generation sequencing.
Well, she had had two breast cancers and a DCIS. So she had really basically three previous cancers, and it had been quite a while ago since her last one. And so it was an internal mammary recurrence, which we couldn't biopsy. And I just think it's worth trying to have that information to see what trial that could lead to in the future. You know, in her situation, we, you know, can use palbociclib and an aromatase inhibitor, but we know eventually she'll have a recurrence again. So it would be nice to point to the direction of some other therapy.
It's interesting that you have the proactive approach to this. I have heard the other side of the coin, people saying that, at least from a practical point of view in taking care of patients today, that it sometimes causes a lot of confusion. There's a lot of different mutations and maybe not necessarily very practical.
Well, I think that's correct. I mean, I agree with that. It's the argument against doing it is that even if you get a result, let's say you do get a mutation, a PI3 kinase mutation, and does that mean they'll respond to a PI3 kinase inhibitor? No, not necessarily. So we don't know what to do with the data. So it isn't incredibly practical right now, but I think it will be useful in the future, and especially for these patients who are recurring now. As science is marching on and we're learning more and more, I just think it's more data that we have to try to help figure out the puzzle.